We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages and hear this story tonight. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Sarah comes to us. She's got well over a year of sobriety. This is the first time that she's telling her story, sharing her story with us. She is a great asset to the club here and some of the other groups that she attends. And she's a very talented artist, vocalist. We don't have much backup for her tonight, but maybe she'll sing us a little tune somewhere. Okay, Sarah, come on up. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Sierra, and I am an alcoholic. I'm really glad to see familiar faces, and I'm not nervous, I'm just kind of excited. I just got to tell you that ever since I came to this clubhouse and went to my first speaker meeting here, I've been rehearsing it in my head, so hopefully something helpful will come out of this. I just wanted to take a moment to invite my higher power in. Okay, yes, I am an alcoholic, and hearing my story, I think you'll agree with me. I was born on April 10th, 1968 in, yes, I'm 40, and that was in Southern California. I was named Bonnie Lynn Cermak for 2 months, and then I was adopted and named Kimberly Diane Martin for most of my life. Yeah, I know, you're surprised. I'll get to the Sierra part later. My parents are both college educated. My dad made 6 figures a year. He has 2 master's degrees, one in chemistry and one in MBA. He is what they would call an A-type personality. OCD, as some people may call it, anal. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom, the milk and cookies mom. She would always be there with the milk and the cookies or whatever when I came home from school. You know, how was your day, dear? You know, and all of that. I have an older brother. His name is Craig. He's 2 years older than I am. And I think from the minute that I came home, was adopted into that house, he had issues with me. And I grew up in an affluent suburb of Los Angeles. We had a nice big yard and a hot tub in the back. And my parents would do the social thing, and they had wine tasting parties and beer tasting parties and other kinds of parties, and there was alcohol around. I can't say if they're alcoholic or not. I doubt it highly. They're just social drinkers. But there was alcohol around when I was growing up, and I played the little barmaid from a very early age where they would say, go get me another glass of whatever, and I knew the difference between Merlot and Burgundy and Riesling and Chardonnay from a very young age. Everything looked good on the outside. We had new cars every 3 years. We went on family vacations all over the place. And my family is a big traveling family. They like to go all over the world. My aunt and uncle were stationed overseas with the diplomatic corps. That's what they did for a living, and my family would go and visit them. And, you know, like I said, everything looked good on the outside. But on the inside, it was a chaotic hell, really, for me. My brother has, to put it mildly, rage problems. And like I said, from the cradle, I think, he physically abused me. And it was the horrible kind of abuse, you know, dragging me around the house and hitting me up against the wall, making it look like an accident, like I would trip over something or whatever. He also used to like to be what I call the terrorist, where I didn't think he was home and I was the only one in the house. And he would make the dishes in the dish drainer settle, you know, by throwing a dime at it or something. And I'd go in the other room and then he'd, you know, jump out at me and scare me, and to this day that bothers me. You know, how people jump out at you and scare you and, you know, whatever, and it's supposed to be some fun. I still have an issue with that. And so that was, the abuse continued until I was 21. And it was really hard. And, you know, I didn't know that that wasn't normal. I didn't know any other kind of way of life. I just thought everybody, when they said that they, you know, were at the dentist yesterday when they missed school, I thought everybody had a broken nose or a black eye or whatever. I didn't know that that was not a normal way to grow up. I didn't know I could tell my teachers. I didn't know that I could tell a clergyman or whatever, get some help for that. I didn't know. And speaking of clergymen, we went to church every Sunday. I sang in the choir from a very young age. And I've always loved music and always loved singing. And my parents are big singing people, too. And they're in a professional music group up in Knoxville that they live up in Knoxville now. And so on the outside, they were the pillars of the community. And, you know, and it was our secret. You don't talk about this kind of thing. And so growing up like that with all of that chaos on the inside, I sought escape at a very young age. And at first it was into books. I love to read to this day. I love reading. And Little House on the Prairie was always a favorite. And when the videos came out, I would just lose myself in movies and lose myself in my Barbies and other just fantasies. And by the age of 9, I knew something about alcohol. And I was with a group of kids, and I was really uncomfortable. I was very socially inept. I didn't have close friendships with the other kids. I was always on the outside. I was never on the in-group. You know, I was always picked last for kickball and all of that. And I couldn't get along with anybody. And so I was with this group of kids, and one of the kids' dad had the liquor store across the lake from where we were. And I remember to this day the sound of the bottles of Colt 45, the 40-ouncers that he put in his jacket, and he was running up the hill. And I looked at those warm bottles of Colt 45. I said, that's going to change the way I feel. And it did. And I chased after that change ever since. And that day I blacked out. And I don't remember the drive home. I don't know how my mom didn't smell Colt 45 on her 9-year-old daughter, but my mom's way of dealing with a lot of things is denial anyway. So from the age of 9, I found the magic potion. It wasn't until I was in high school that I really started drinking heavily. But I was always sneaking drinks and playing the little barmaid. So at 9, that's the first drink that I can remember looking at the bottle and saying, that's going to change the way I feel. But I had had alcohol before that. Like I said, my parents had these parties and everything, and so it was no new thing to have alcohol around. And by the age of 13, I found marijuana and other drugs. And man, you know, I found what I was looking for. I didn't have to worry about how much I got the shit beat out of me. I didn't have to worry about fitting in. I didn't have to worry about, you know, all of the problems at school and people telling me I wasn't living up to my potential and all of that crap. I found escape. And during all of this time, I was pretty good at school or whatever. I liked school. It was also an escape. Nobody was beating on me or whatever. And my parents, about age 13, 14, 15, started, you know, they'd come home from choir practice, and the house would be a mess, and I'd be bloody and whatever. And they started saying things like, well, what did you do to piss him off? And I really got the sense that it was somehow my fault. And by the age of about 15, I was suicidal. And I didn't know how to tell anybody. I was too chicken to really kill myself, but I didn't have a gun, or we didn't have guns in the house or anything. I didn't know how I would do it, but I wanted the pain to end. And about that time, there was a new choir director in high school, and I found another escape. And I was in the plays and the musicals and very involved in choir, and that was another escape for me, being able to act any way I wanted and people approve of that, and that was a really cool thing for me. I did graduate high school after being warned several times that I wasn't going to because I failed one geometry or something that you needed some kind of math that you needed to graduate. But I did graduate, and the first thing that I wanted to do was get the hell out of that house. And so I went to Colorado State, which is, you know, totally crazy. And that first year in college was a total failure. The first semester, I did try. I did try, and I went to class, and I tried, and but it just wasn't my thing. It really wasn't my thing at the time. I was out of my element. I didn't know how to balance a checkbook. I thought, well, hell, I still have checks in there. How can I be overdrawn, you know? And, you know, I just had no life skills at all. They just kind of dumped me off, got back on the train the same day, and I was in a totally different state. And everybody in Colorado thought that people from California all sat on the beach all day and ate granola and yogurt, and they had a big misconception. And here I was with my tie dyes and my hippie stuff on, and I really didn't fit in. And they made sure that I knew that I didn't fit in. Although I did fit in with the big drinkers. And when I went to Colorado State, they had the 18 and over was how you could drink there. And I was in heaven. I could legally drink. Oh, my God. And so that's where you would find me. There was this bowling alley that was downstairs that would serve pitchers until the lights went out. And that's where you'd find me. And I really didn't do very well in college that year. And the second semester, I dropped all of my classes, and I just hung out around the dorms because they were already paid for, right? And I had my meal card, and I would just go out and do drugs and alcohol all the time. And that was how I spent about four months. And, you know, I came back, and I was like, you know, this college thing just really didn't work out for me. And so that became, like, the theme of my life. You know, I really don't think that's what I need to be doing right now. So that was when I was about 19, and from like 19 to 29, I would say I had a hit-and-run kind of existence. It was all about drugs. It was all about alcohol, and it was all about escaping from who I was and the pain. About 21 was the last time that I got abused by my brother, and it was in between... when I had gotten some help finally for the depression, because the depression was obvious, you know, the drinking and using, they didn't want to deal with that, so they sent me to the psychiatrist. And it was around Christmas time, and my psychiatrist said, I was worried about, oh my God, my brother's going to be there, I don't want him to be there at Christmas time, whatever. And a revelation came over me through the mouth of my psychiatrist, and she said, you don't have to be in the same room with him if you don't want to be. Wow, I didn't know that. And so I chose not to be with my family for Christmas. And it was hard, and they didn't understand. And Christmas is a big deal at my house. So from 21 to 22, 3, around in there, I followed the Grateful Dead. I was running around with my tribe. And I had found another form of heaven. People who drank and used like I did, people who didn't give a shit about society, and I was dropping out and all of that happy stuff. And but on the inside, I was still very unhappy. There was still that chaos, and I couldn't get close to people. The way I got close to them was to sell them drugs or to get them the booze they wanted or whatever. I would buy these friendships. And when I was 23, I got pregnant. And it was just... you know, a one-night stand that lasted about 2 weeks, and I went, wow, you know, maybe it's time for my period, and it didn't come, and I was like, oh, my God. And I have a 16-year-old daughter now, and she lived with me for about 4 years. And then when she was about 4 years old, she was really interfering with my drinking and using. And I did some things that I'm not proud of as a mother. I would leave her alone and go down to the bar. You know, when she was an infant, I'd wait till she'd go to sleep overnight and go down to the bar. I did crazy things like I moved to this one particular apartment, even though I couldn't really afford it because it was a block away from my favorite bar. I tried to go to school sometime during this, and it just didn't work out again. And I was having anxiety attacks and all kinds of depression problems. And I really think that I chose drugs and alcohol over my daughter, and I'm not proud of that, but that is my story. So from the time she was 4 until today, she's lived with her dad. I gave her to her dad on a temporary basis until I got my stuff together, and it's been 12 years. So I moved up to this place to go to massage school, up to another city to go to massage school. And I was free of the chains of motherhood, and that's when I hit my first bottom. And I got sober when I was 29 years old the first time. And the reason I got sober that time was because I was homeless. I had drunk my way into homelessness and crazy, crazy relationships and almost getting raped once and, you know, just all of those situations that we women alcoholics put ourselves in. And I got sober by calling a helpline. And there was this place that took me in, and I called my parents and said, you know, I think I'm going to quit drinking. Can you help me get into this place? And it was called Casa Serena. And when I was homeless, I was the kind of drunk that you see down at the park or in this case, at the beach. And, you know, passing around the bottle in the paper bag, drinking every day, using whatever drugs I could get my hands on, just to escape the pain of who I was. And so I got into Casa Serena, and I had no idea what getting sober was about. I had no idea. And I had, like I said, I never fit in. I couldn't make relationships work. And within, I think it was 60 days I made it there, within 60 days they said, you know, you're having too many problems with the girls here. So you need to leave for about 5 days, see if someplace else will take you. But you can come back after 5 days. And I said, okay. So I went to go live with my grandma for 5 days in Southern California, and I came back. And within 2 weeks, they said, you know, you have problems other than drugs and alcohol, and you need to go get treatment for those. So I went to a place called Hope House. And I got down to causes and conditions like it talks about in the big book. I did primal scream therapy at this place, which helped me out immensely. I got out a lot of the rage and anger and resentment that I had toward my family and toward my brother. And I started healing a lot of that stuff. And it was inpatient, sort of. It was residential, but like lockdown. You could not leave without a group of people or go to the treatment place across the street or to the doctor, whatever. You could not leave. And they were very strict and very structured. And I needed that a lot. And I left there after about 90 days, 60, 90 days, something like that. And I moved in with my grandmother, God bless her. And before this, I had lived with my grandma, too. And she always kept her money in a certain place that I found out about. And when I was drinking and using, I would steal money whenever I wanted to. It really wasn't mainly for the reason to get drunk, but of course I got drunk on the money. And this was when I was supposed to be taking care of her. She had had a stroke, a mild stroke, but she couldn't take care of herself or button her shirt or whatever. And so I was there as the adult to take care of her. And so I went back to live with her for a while, and that's when I got sober, really sober. I had a sponsor. She would call me up and say, get ready. We're going somewhere. You know, I'll be there in 10 minutes. And I'd be going, well, where are we going? And she'd say, don't worry about it. Just get ready. We're going there. We go on 12-step calls. We go do service work. We go to meetings. I helped her clean out her garage that was supposed to, you know, help keep me sober or whatever. You know, those kinds of things. And I was really involved. I was a chairperson of this meeting. I was GSR for that meeting. I had 2 home groups. I went to meetings all the time. I had a job. And my grandma set me up with a car. And things were going well for about 22 months. For about 20 months. And then my sponsor moved to a town far away, and I couldn't use her as a sponsor anymore. And to this day, now that I have a better understanding of the program, I think she was really my higher power, and I really think that she kept me sober, and just all that activity around people who were not drinking. But once I hit about 22 months and she wasn't around, I just said, F it. You know, why do this? I had moved out of my grandma's house. I had that car, and I just said, F it. the sober boyfriend that I had broken up with me because his sponsor said that he should. And yeah, you get that. And I was still not having any successful relationships, even being sober. And so I went out for about a year. In that year, I met my husband. And the way I met my husband was I went out to this hippie fest out in the desert, and he drove up in his white convertible Mustang, and he did the most alluring thing that you could do to me at that time, which was to offer me a pipe full of really good green bud. And I was in love, and I really did fall in love with him, and I married him for all the right reasons. Unfortunately, he's a normie, and he didn't get it, and I was also still very damaged from my childhood at that time. He helped me heal a lot of that. So in the year 2000, June 24th, the year 2000, I got married. And I hadn't gotten married before I was 32, mainly because I was such a mess, and nobody wanted to put up with me for more than a few nights, you know? And so during this marriage, I learned a lot about myself, and I also got sober for another time for about 9 months. And that time, it was all for him. It was not for any of the right reasons. That's one of the reasons why it only lasted 9 months. And then I did my fourth step and fifth step with my sponsor at the time. And unfortunately, even though she had 20 years of sobriety, she was A, human, and B, needed her meds mellowed out or something because she had a lot of mental problems. And she ended up sharing my fifth step in a meeting, some of it. Yeah, I heard the gasp. And I was like, wow. And I used that as an excuse to go out again. I just said, F it. And especially you women, you know, I can't trust you women, don't you know? You know, I couldn't trust my mother, my birth mother. You know, I was abandoned by her, so that just set that all up. And I said, you know, women in the program, and the program sucks, and I don't need this. And I went out running again, and that was a very dark time, drinking and using a lot. I ended up cheating on my husband a lot. And it was just a horrible time of life. And that was when I began the rounds of the institutions. And, you know, I'd go in for the depression or whatever, and they'd talk to me about my drug and alcohol use, and then they'd put me in a different ward for duly addicted or whatever and all of that. And, you know, and I was on and off psych meds, and I was just such a mess, major mess. And that meant I can say today, from doing my amends to my husband, my ex-husband, and from long discussions with my sponsor, that he is a good guy. I ruined that relationship. How I came to Georgia was, we got married in California in 2000. We moved to Idaho on a geographic. And then everything was so dark and dismal up there and everything, and it was cloudy all the time, and I was diagnosed with SAD, seasonal affective disorder, because I wasn't getting enough sunshine, and I was also drinking and using a lot. And again, I couldn't get along with my mother-in-law, and my grandma died in 2002. And that was a huge loss for me. My grandma was a huge part of my life. She was always there. I didn't know any of my other grandparents. They were either deceased or my dad's dad didn't live around us, so I never really saw him. But my grandma was always there. She came to all my plays and musicals and my graduation and my recitals and all of that. And she was a big part of our family. And she died in 2002. And I really wish I could be more like her. I really do. She's one of those people that, you know, you say that phrase, salt of the earth. You know, I never saw her angry or say a crossword to anybody. And it was a huge loss for me. And it was even worse for my mom. And my mom was having a hard time with it. And they had already moved to Knoxville by this time. And so my idea in my drunken stupor was, we'll move to Knoxville. And so I knew enough about my drinking and using that I didn't want my mom, like, dropping in every day or anything. So we looked around Chattanooga for a job for my husband and me and a place to live. And the first place that he could get a job was in Dalton, Georgia. And that's how I came to Georgia. It had nothing to do with looking at the state or any pre-planning or anything. We came with $1,000 in our pocket, and that was it, you know, in my car. And that was it. And I lived in Dalton for a few years. And Dalton is a very dark time. That was where I was cheating on my husband all the time. He's a long-haul trucker. I had no idea what being a trucker's wife was like. And he was home twice a week or less. And I had to make my own life. And so I did. And my kind of life is, hey, let's party. And so that's what I did. I became the karaoke queen of Dalton. And that was my outlet right then. And so like 3 or 4 times a week, I'd go out karaokeing. I never knew who I would end up at the end of the night. And I just lived that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that they talk about. In August of 2006, I got the bright alcoholic idea that, you know, this marriage really wasn't working because he's always away and blah, 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 and I could go down the list of why I justified it. And so I left my husband in August of 2006. And I started living with this other guy that I met on the internet. And he was everything I thought I wanted. And he did a lot for me in a lot of ways. And he put me up, and he put up with me. And he was what I would call a normie. He liked to party once in a while, but I think he was a normie. And by this time, I already had one DUI when I was in Dalton. But that didn't stop me from drinking and driving. It didn't stop me from driving on a suspended license. It didn't stop me from drinking all the time. So I took what I could pack, and I left my husband, and I started living up in Woodstock. And it was idyllic for about a month. And then I got my second DUI, November 2006. Actually, what's the date today? Well, this week, 2 years ago, I got my second DUI. And that second DUI plays a big part in why I got sober this time. And so I lived with him until about February of 2007. And because of the DUI, he couldn't stand the drama, and he started pulling away from me, and he was making my life hell. And he was just emotionally distant and cheating on me, so it was kind of, you know, the flip side of that, and lying and lying and lying and lying. And I was really, really hurt because I thought I loved this man. And because I had left my husband in August, my parents didn't even invite me to Thanksgiving that year. They were not talking to me at this point. They really, to this day, love my ex-husband. My mom still calls him on his birthday. And that Christmas, I decided I wanted to be with my family for Christmas. And they, you know, got the message on the phone, and my dad called back in his stern way and said, if you bring that man up here, we're calling the cops. And they'd never met Chris. They'd never seen him. They didn't know. But because I had left my husband and then moved in with this guy, he had to be evil. And so Christmas of that year was hell. Thanksgiving of that year was hell. And I was doing that depressive drinking downward cycle. I wouldn't get drunk every day at this time. That's not part of my story at the end. I would drink 2 or 3 glasses of wine and be able to quit. I would be able to have a couple beers and be able to quit. It wasn't like before when I was drinking every day and blacking out all the time and everything. But that demoralization was in there. And my parents weren't talking to me, and my daughter wasn't talking to me. And so about January of 2007, I got so depressed that I got suicidal again. And I called the suicide hotline because the guy that I was living with couldn't be bothered to talk me out of suicide. And so I went downstairs and I called the suicide hotline, and she said two things that saved my life. The first thing is, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And the second is, go back to AA. And so I did. And about early February 2007, I started going back to AA. I was still smoking my pot every day. But I knew that had to end too. It was always easier for me to put down the alcohol. And so on February 14th, 2007, I had my last drink. I went out to dinner for Valentine's Day because a friend of mine felt sorry for me because my boyfriend was kicking me out of the house, making me homeless. And so he said, well, I'll treat you to a nice Valentine's dinner. So we went out, and we had this very expensive bottle of French wine. And I had two glasses or however many. And, you know, because that's all. We had one apiece and then two apiece, and then it was gone. And I remember looking at that bottle and saying, I can't ask him for another one because it's $40 a bottle or whatever it was. You know, it's too expensive, so I can't do that. And I didn't have any money on me to go get some more beer or anything. And so that was my last drink. And I, even though it was only two and it wasn't some nightmarish experience or anything, I knew that that was my last drink. I went to court the next day, which is my sobriety date, February 15th. I went to court that next day. Scared to death I was going to go to jail on this DUI. Scared to death. But I made a deal with the judge that he would put off my sentencing for 6 months so that I could come to Atlanta and get sober. I had called a place that I don't even think exists anymore, Peachford House, and they said, yeah, we have a bed for you on Friday. Come on down. So I did. I packed up what little things I could manage. My boyfriend couldn't be bothered to bring me down here, so I had a friend of mine that I'd known in the AA rooms up in Woodstock come down, and I got into Peachford House, and I started coming to meetings here. And my sponsor will tell you, I was a mess. I was very angry. I wanted to keep everybody at a distance, you know. I really wanted you to get to know who I was, but I didn't know how to do that. And so the beginning of my sobriety here was kind of disappointing. In this very room, I remember after a week or two being here, crying because I couldn't find a woman sponsor, crying because the women here were not like the women out in California, saying, oh, my God, I know I need a sponsor. I know what to do. I know I need to work the steps. I know I need to get what's really going on out. I know what the problem is. It's me. It's not the bottle, it's not the pipe, it's not any of that, it's me. And I really got that. And I really heard it for the first time, that part in How It Works that talks about constitutionally incapable of being honest, and the grave emotional and mental disorders. I really got that, and I thought, I have to do this. This is, you know, I have to do this. And I could hear things, even though I was like Miss AA that first time that I got sober, and I could quote the big book and whatever, it didn't mean that much inside. And so I started on this journey. I finally found a sponsor that I could work with. And I started on this journey. And I lived at that God-blessed halfway house for 7.5 months. And I learned a lot. One of the things that I learned is the most spiritual thing I can do probably in any given situation is shut my mouth. And that other people will dig their own holes. And it's not my job to fix them. And I also got in touch with this higher power thing that you guys talk about in here. And that's the biggest difference for me in my whole life. And today I have a God in my life. I am a great intellectual or pseudo-intellectual. And I had taken these religious studies classes, and I had, you know, talked about the idea of God and studied different religions and everything. And when I came in here, I knew what I didn't believe. I knew what I thought was a pack of horseshit, but I didn't know what I did believe. And I relaxed and I took it easy like you guys kept telling me to. And I quit the debating society like it talks about. And I have found a God of my understanding. It isn't something I can describe. And somebody put it so eloquently last week in this very meeting. He said that there are particles that are at the subatomic level that we can't see with even our best microscopes, but you can see where they've been. And that's kind of what I think God is for me. I can't see what that entity is, but I can see in you all, since I've been around here for 20 months, and you guys have been coming around here and changing for me and around me, and showing me that God is here. And that's the first place that I saw God was in the eyes of you guys, in recovering people. And that has made all the difference. I am one of those people that needs a power greater than myself. And I try to get in touch with that power in various ways. I come to lots of meetings. And I try to share in meetings. And I've read a lot of spiritual books lately. That's what's been happening lately. I've come to a lot of, I've had spiritual experiences along the lines. Those spiritual experiences started happening when I was in the God Blessed Halfway House, and my sponsor with her busy life was not available. My network was not available. The girls in the house, I had more time than they did anyway, and they didn't want recovery. And I would shut myself up in my room, and my mind was just going a million miles an hour, and I couldn't read the literature. And so that's when I found out that there is a power greater than me. And I would pray a lot, you know. I'd get on my knees, and, you know, I was famous for that around the halfway house. Oh, there goes Sierra. She's praying again. And, you know, all of that. And, but it saved my ass. It really did. And like I said, I can't tell you what God is and what God isn't. I just know He is, it is, she is, whatever you want to call it. And I know that God works. God works in my life. I see Him working in your life. So when I got out of the halfway house, I went to go live with a guy. You know, I was 7.5 months sober. And I went to go live with a guy, and I learned so much from that. And we're still friends today. We are no longer together, but we're still friends today. And I learned a lot from that man. And I watched him a year ago this week, his mom died. And I got to watch him walk through that without drinking. And I didn't realize until I saw him do that I had the reservation. I had a reservation. I had been so committed to not drinking and using no matter what, not drinking and using no matter what, that I didn't realize there was, if I honestly told, you know, let myself be honest, that I had a reservation that if anything happened to my parents or my daughter, that I would go drink again. Whatever. That was my reservation. So when I saw him walk through that, and recently, the lady who owns the house that I live in now, she lost her husband recently. And I watched her walk through that with grace and dignity and using the principles of the program, and she didn't get drunk. And when I see people go through horrible life experiences like that and not get drunk, it gives me hope. And, because for most of my life, that was my answer. You know, you looked at me sideways, I'd go get drunk. A horrible thing would happen, I'd go get drunk. Some chaos I created would go down, and I would go get drunk. That was my answer to everything. When I was happy, I would go get drunk, you know. And so to find out that there is another way to live, and that it has something to do with this higher power thing you guys talk about in here, was an amazing thing for me. When I did my first, second, and third step and got into my fourth step with my sponsor, I had a pretty good idea by that time what God was about. And I really did try to be open and honest and get down to causes and conditions and do a thorough fifth step. And I remember to this day me going through it, and we were sitting at her kitchen table, and she's writing down this stuff. And, you know, I'd say something about this or that, and she's writing down this stuff. I'm like, what's she writing? I don't know. And then I went outside. Her phone rang or something, and we took a little break. I went outside for a cigarette, and something else that I hadn't written down came up. And I went out there and I prayed and I said, okay, can I tell this to her? Can I tell this big secret to her? Can I tell this huge resentment to her? And I said, hell, you know, you've already told all this other crap today. Why not this, right? So I went back in and I said, there's one more thing that I need to tell you. And I told her that. And I did not realize the freedom that would come from that. And I did not realize what a spiritual experience that would be. And my very first sponsor, when I did my very, very first fifth step, I was on the debating society about the God thing and, you know, whatever. And I just couldn't get this higher power thing. And so she had me move on to the fourth and fifth step. And after I did the fifth step that first time, she said, okay, Sierra, you have had a spiritual experience. And I looked around and I thought, there's no burning bush. There was no lightning bolt. The ceiling is still intact. What are you talking about with the spiritual experience thing? I did not get it back then. Now I see, and what she told me was the spiritual experience was, you've just been totally honest with another human being. And I went, oh, wow. I didn't get it. And so now I get that. When I go back and I say, you know, it didn't happen like that, I lied to you. Or when I try to, you know, say I'm sorry, or one of those things, those are spiritual experiences to me. When I try to act in a different way than I normally would, that I know will probably create chaos. You know, and my life today, 20 months later, is no bed of roses. It is not happy, joyous, and free every day. But there is a freedom on the inside. There is a joy on the inside, and it's very calm. You know, the joy that I thought was that chaotic kind of roller coaster joy that I thought when I was drinking, and now it's a very subtle, kind of contented feeling. And sometimes I don't like that, and I like to create some more chaos so that, you know, there's something to focus on, and, you know, it won't get so boring and everything, but that's getting better too. I know that there is a way out today, and I know that it's found here in these rooms, it's found in my literature, it's found talking to my sponsor and the people in my network, people that I respect and I love and hear. And that's why it's so exciting to see you guys here tonight. I look around at these faces, and if I've known you before tonight, a lot of people I haven't ever seen before, but the ones that I do know are little points in my journey. You know, my sponsors here, the other girls that live in the recovery house are here. A sponsee is here. Lori's here. She's falling asleep. But you know, some of my spiritual gurus are here. People that I turn to when I need some support, and people that I've reached out to, hopefully to help them. And that's how it works around here. And I'm so glad for that. There's a situation happening to me right now at work, and I'm really having to dig deep. This morning, I was not a spiritual guru. This morning, I was not trusting my higher power. I was crying to my sponsor at 7:30 in the morning, and I apologize. I was not going to go to work today because of this chaos that I had a hand in at work. I was just not going to go to work today, but I did. I did the sober thing. I went to work. I feel much better. I have a little bit more money in my pocket. I did the next right thing, which is something that I learned about in here. The most challenging thing that's going on in my life right now, though, is making amends to my daughter. How do you make amends for being absent for 12 years? Now, of course, I always did the obligatory $10 in the birthday card and called her on Christmas and her birthday and blah, blah, blah. Saw her over the years. Called her occasionally over the years. But I haven't been a mother to her. And that has affected me deeply. And that's going to be a challenge. She's not talking to me right now. She just sent an ugly email, but an honest email about her memories of me. And it was very hard to read. But I'm in that part right now of my ninth step, which is catching up with some of the biggies. I thought the biggie was going to be my ex-husband, but I did that one last year. No, that was not the biggie. The biggie is my daughter and my parents, because they've been going through this shit for 40 years, right? So I do the living amends to them. And the best amends that I can make to my daughter right now, because we aren't communicating, I have written the letter and it's sitting in the mailbox to be picked up tomorrow. But, you know, how do you respond to this 16-year-old, you know, when you know that you have not been there? What do you do? And so that's when the women in this program really helped me out. They have come up to me with tons and tons of love and experience and strength and hope with that. And I have hope that that can be healed. It's going to take time. It's going to take commitment. I'm not good at that. But I do love my daughter, and I want things to be better between us. Now, whether or not it's going to be some reunion of us running across the room into each other's arms, you know, I doubt it. But I know that if I stay sober today, that I have a chance of healing that. And so I want to thank you all for being here tonight. Oh, the Sierra story. Okay, real quick. When I was a camp counselor, one of my summers, when I was 18 years old, my college hadn't worked out. So I said, well, I'll just go run away to the hills, and I'll be a camp counselor, which is the best job I ever had. Teaching girls how to shoot archery and ride horses and hike and the names of the different flowers and trees and birds. I'm all about that. I'm a nature lover hippie from way back. My camp name was Sierra. There was a guy who believed in a lot of the Indian theology, if you will, and he made a naming ceremony for me. And so I am Sierra Singing Hawk. And that is, hey, don't laugh. And that is my spiritual name. And so that is how I came to be called Sierra. And for the past 20 years, off and on, I've been called Sierra. It's not my legal name, but please call me Sierra. With love. And I love you guys. Thank you.